May it please the court, opposing counsel. I'm very appreciative of this opportunity to come here and spend a little bit over a half hour discussing some of the, I think, very important issues in both aspects. I think the first issue in front of the court regarding notice is very important to jurisprudence in this court as a whole, and I think that the second issue is very important to all the parties involved. The first issue on notice, the question before this court is it sufficient notice, and is there not a sufficient conflict when the only guardian of a third party in an ancillary proceeding is also the spouse of a defendant that's currently looking at some really hard, serious prison time? I agree with the United States.
Should they have given then?
I apologize.
What would have been an adequate notice here?
Adequate notice would have been some sort of guardian ad litem, some sort of attorney ad litem, some individual that was not the spouse of somebody that's looking at going to prison for a long time. I think that the inherent conflict was recognized by the United States government when later in the proceeding they came forward and stated, Your Honor, this petition that was filed by the same lawyer as was representing the defendant has some real problems in that there's a conflict, and we can't have...
What is the conflict?
The conflict is that the lawyer is representing both the criminal that was using the property as well as the minor that owned the property. There's an assumption or a presumption in the law, as was acknowledged in the brief of the United States government, that when a deed is duly recorded, there's a presumption that it is valid. I think it's very significant in this case that that deed was recorded, a gift to my client from her grandfather in 2001. I think it's very significant as well that the conspiracy allegation and the drug trafficking allegations by the government against my client's father began in 2006, which is 5 years before or 5 years after the transference occurred. Now, obviously, those issues go more to the second prong on the summary judgment that was granted. Certainly,
I don't understand where the conflict is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the conflict
between
is
between the mother and her child. Mm-hmm. What is the because, in fact, in this case, the mother did file a petition on behalf of her child. So, to the extent she felt some pull, which I still you would need to articulate, why would she not want to file something on behalf of her child?
Well, that's a very fair question, Your Honor. I think that's a very important issue. I think that the issues are difficult, particularly when, and you'd think, yes, you're always going to take your child over your husband, but I don't
but
think
I don't understand how it hurts her husband for her child to get the house.
Because as part of the plea deal, the husband's saying, okay, government, yeah, take this property. Of course you can take this property that doesn't belong to me. And, you know, that was part and parcel.
But she does file a petition. So you're saying she waited too long on purpose because she was conflicted. Is that in the record?
Well, that's not in the record, Your Honor. I think that the conflict is on its face, and I think that it certainly is a factor.
Well, did the father here take the position it was his property and forfeit for that reason, or did he take the position that you get what you want to? But
I believe he took the position, if anything, that it was his property. He certainly was using it, and he certainly stated.
I understand that, but what was his position?
Well, his position was. But it
and
was
a plea, you said it affected plea bargain. What was the plea deal?
The plea deal was he got about 5 years.
No. I mean, what were the terms, relevant terms of the plea regarding the property?
Mm-hmm. The government gets to take it. 5 years, the government gets a whole bunch of property, and 5 years later, I'm a free man.
Well, he says, oh, you get my property, but that's not admitting that house is his property.
That's true. I think, though, that it was argued. It was certainly used by him. I think the question is whether or not that indicates that it is a property and that he has a stronger claim. And
you're
certainly,
saying the procedure should be that every single time that a minor is involved in some notice, that the government should have to seek the appointment of the court of a guardian or ad litem or to appear on behalf of the minor seek that at the initiation, and then that's the requirement on the government.
I think I don't know about every case. I think that certainly would be a valid rule. I'm not sure that would be a bad rule.
No court has ever required that.
That's true, Your Honor, although it's very, this issue has very rarely come up. I suspect from a practical standpoint, the reason for that is it's very rare that somebody, if it is in fact truly some sort of scheme to hide it from the government, that they're going to just miss the deadline. I think that that is highly unusual. And I think that that also speaks as to the second prong.
Do you lose automatically if there's no inherent conflict because the minor child was served through her mother timely?
Yes. If there's no conflict, either by being represented by the same attorney, which the government argued and which the district court did accept, or under the specific facts of this case, where the mother is representing the child but also has a spouse that's currently in a whole lot of trouble.
And there's nothing in the record that says she delayed because of some moral quandary she was having.
There's nothing in the record one way or the other on that issue. There's certainly no, she never came forward.
She was late.
She was late, Your Honor.
And that's it. And therefore you lose.
Well, I don't know if it's that simple. I think that in this particular case, if you were to follow that line of logic to the conclusion, you'd say, well, if she didn't do anything, then maybe we'll give the right, which means that you'd be putting this court for the future in a position where you have to look at, well, if they're just wholly deficient, maybe we're going to give this child some relief. But if they simply miss a deadline, we're not. And I think that jurisprudentially, that would be a very, very difficult rule to follow. I think that that would be a very difficult to implement.
Was the mother in any jeopardy legally?
I apologize.
Was the mother in any jeopardy of being indicted herself?
I think certainly in any time there's a situation like this. There's with conspiracy, as a criminal defense attorney and as a former prosecutor, I'd say that anytime there's this sort of ongoing conspiracy, everybody's in danger of being indicted. I know that if I was her attorney, I'd say, you be quiet and don't say anything to anybody because we don't know what's going to happen or what's going to be said or, you know, what would be considered. As broad as the conspiracy laws are, I think that she's under a tremendous amount. I think to ignore that possibility.
Well, factually, the father had already just pled out, or it reached a plea with the government, and apparently no move by the government was directed toward the mother. So that suggests to me that she really wasn't in herself in any criminal jeopardy. I can understand an argument that if the mother might not be the proper person to represent her own child if she's in criminal jeopardy, and she's fearful of rocking the boat because she might get indicted. But I don't get that factually here.
I think in any case, as broad as federal conspiracy laws are, to
not
state
at that juncture. I mean, they've already moved against the father. They didn't move against her.
And Your Honor, in the particular facts of this case, there was also an apartment that was given to her now at a much later point in time after the conspiracy had already begun, as alleged by the government, that was given to her by my client's grandfather. So I think given the fact that she's receiving some property that is at least putatively involved, I think it certainly raises the issue. And I think even if it doesn't, I don't know if necessarily that would... I think that just simply being the spouse logically is enough. I don't think that we can... And I don't think that it would be making good law to state, well, as long as there's a guardian, we're going to ignore. There's certainly some level of conflict there. The government recognized it when they moved to recuse the attorney that was representing them both. The district court judge recognized it when he agreed. And so I think the question is, how far does it go?
To what extent do we rely upon the fact that in Texas law, the parent is the presumed person? Do we care at all that the parent is the presumed person unless someone comes forward or the court becomes aware of actual facts that would show that there is a conflict?
I think that certainly if there's no actual conflict or potential conflict as strong as in this case, then yes, the parent is
the guardian. Do we rely on Texas law, though, to reach this
question? We do, Your Honor. We do, Your Honor, as far as substantive rights.
So the court was not presented with conflict information at the time, and there was no one said you need to certify someone else. The court had no information on that.
Well, I think that they knew that the only guardian was the spouse of a criminal defendant. I would think that's enough. But even if that's not, the fact that an apartment was forfeited that was the, either there was...
But the court didn't know that at the time it made its initial decision, did it?
Well, I think it was on the, it was part of the record, Your Honor.
I thought it didn't come forward till the very end, and the court said, oh, I didn't even know that.
I think that that might have been in the allocution, that, and I think that that would have been information that they had, but I could certainly look into that and give you some further briefing, if Your Honor would like.
It's okay.
And
did anyone live in this property in question?
It's my understanding that they did at one time at the time that it was given, but after the death of the grandfather, the father took custody of it and began using it as a stash house.
So they never lived, the mother and the child were not living
in it? I believe they
did
originally. I believe that was the original childhood home when she was an infant.
But at the time of these events, they were not living in the property.
That is correct, Your Honor, absolutely. But I think that in a lot of ways, and I know that the government in their brief argued very strongly that one of the things you want to look at is how the defendant was looking at the property and how the defendant was using it, not so much the other person. And in support of that, they quoted the case of Braxton versus the United States. And in that case, the facts are significantly different than in this case. In the case of Braxton, the government was already closing in on a gigantic farm, or at least large farm, in Florida where marijuana, methamphetamines was being trafficked. And in sort of a last minute, 11th hour attempt, they gave the property to Braxton, sold it to him for $10. And they, what the court looked at there is, well, you know, one of the factors we look at is how it's being used. And in this case, you know, Braxton isn't really making any attempts to act like it's his property, and it was only $10. But that's, I think, a very, very different fact scenario than we have now.
But that's only as to the summary judgment. That's not as to this notice question.
That's
at
true,
all.
Your Honor. It's two completely separate issues. And if we lose on notice, we lose. I completely acknowledge that. But I think that it's an issue that's never been brought forward. I suspect is not very frequent because I think it's kind of a rare fact scenario that the transfer was made before the conspiracy was even alleged. The government alleged the conspiracy started in 2006. And the transfer occurred in 2001. That's a very unique fact scenario. I think it's also probably a somewhat rare fact scenario that the only guardian of the property is also the wife or spouse of a defendant. I think that there might be some other conflicts that would do it, but certainly a spouse. I think that that has to be strong enough that when you look at the jurisprudence that the court has looked at, specifically the test in Mullane versus Hanover Trust, which is reasonable under the circumstances, and which was later acknowledged and followed in Duesenberry versus United States, where they said we're going to follow the Mullane test, which is reasonable under the circumstances, as opposed to a more complicated balancing test where they overruled Wang. And in Wang, which was quoted in my brief, it was overruled by Duesenberry, and I want to make that very clear because I wouldn't want to give the court false authority. But the issue in that case is whether or not simply giving a certified letter to a jail where a prisoner is that's acknowledged it got to the jail, but we can't see the actual notice.
This is not the same thing at all. It's
Absolutely. Personal
service on the correct person, the parent under Texas law. That's not just leaving it at the jail.
Certainly, I think the question is it a correct person if they're the spouse of a current criminal defendant?
Okay. And you may have already answered this in response to Judge Higginbotham's questions. What additional jeopardy does the criminal defendant, the gentleman, suffer as a result of this house failure to be forfeited to the government?
If he doesn't
get any further penalty, does he?
I believe he can, Your Honor. If the government does not believe that he is testifying truthfully, he could lose some of the...
But it's not about him testifying truthfully. If it turns out that someone else owns the house and is therefore not part of his property, then that has nothing to do with him testifying truthfully.
I think as part of the plea deal, he was giving up the property. And I think that if he comes in and says, oh, well, it turns out the part of the deal that I really can't give that to the government, I think that he is in serious jeopardy.
Well, he's not doing that. It's the fact that she may have some superior interest in a deed.
Yes, and I think that it's very interesting. What he said was, it was his understanding that it was his father's intent to give him that property, and I don't think that that can reasonably trump his actual actions of giving it to his granddaughter. I don't know, I don't think it would be right to take the presumed transfer, which is presumed under Texas law, and say, well, we're going to take the word of a criminal as so far beyond that that we're going to accept that. I see that my time is up. Unless
yes, you've saved time for rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Foster. Mr. Doyle?
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry with the voice. May it please the Court, Gerald Doyle on behalf of the United States. I would add as a footnote that this is my first opportunity to have the privilege to appear and argue case before the Court. I appreciate that privilege. I also sincerely appreciate this Court staff and the many hospitalities that they have provided. Your Honor, 6 months ago, this Court decided the United States versus Marquez, 685 Fed Third 501, which was just the subject of a Rule 28J letter for the simple purpose that the Court stated at that time that criminal forfeiture procedures are not empty formalities and they serve a vital function. In that case, the District Court failed to follow the procedures of Rule 32.2. We don't have that in this case. Senior District Court Judge Hayden Head followed the procedures. He immediately issued a preliminary order of forfeiture. The United States followed the procedures under 32.2 and Section 853N in serving notice on any potential claimants. And they served notice on the appellant by serving it to the appellant, a minor, care of her mother, a natural parent with whom she was living at the time. The mother accepted service on behalf of the minor. The United States also personally served the mother in her individual capacity. The United States also personally served the paternal grandmother, the spouse of the grandfather who conveyed the property to the minor. The appellant complains in page 10 of her brief about the notice suggesting that the United States, quote, failed to give sufficient notice under existing case law as would apply to adults with no legal inabilities to defend against this type of forfeiture. And I would argue to the Court that the Court's ruling in United States versus Stone is dispositive of the type of what the standard is for sufficiency of notice under Section 853N. And in that case, which is cited in the government's brief beginning at page 21, the Court followed the Mullane standard and said that notice under Section 853 must be reasonably calculated under all the circumstances to apprise interested parties of the pendency of the action and afford them an opportunity to present their objections. The Court further stated that this focus on reasonableness is not done blindly, that the Court looks at the circumstances. Your Honor, the questions that have already been asked of the appellant's attorney relate to the conflict and what conflict there might have been regarding the mother. Now, frankly, there was no conflict regarding the mother's representation of the minor, and in the record at page 191, the claim is filed by the mother as both parent and guardian of the appellant. There is no conflict in her representation as a guardian for the minor. The attorney was disqualified not because of any representation regarding the conflict he had representing the minor. The order of disqualifying counsel is at the record on page 285. And after hearing a telephone conference with that attorney and the United States brought that motion to disqualify him. The Court says, Mr. Perez previously represented Mr. Alvarez, the defendant, in the underlying criminal case and may possess confidential information adverse to Mr. Alvarez's defense in this case. Your Honor, there's nothing in the record to suggest that there was any conflict that the mother had in acting as a guardian or parent on behalf of the minor and bringing the claim. There's also nothing in the record that Mr. Perez had any conflict.
Other than the fact that she didn't timely, she went 72 days to respond to it.
Well, absolutely. And that goes to the second point. There are really two stages to the procedural issue. One is the standard, which is Stone, and whether or not the minor got, and that's what's raised in the brief, whether or not the minor got sufficient notice. And clearly the position of the United States is that the standard under Mullane has been satisfied.
Not only that, she didn't even ask the district court to extend the time for excusable neglect.
So, absolutely.
So
nope.
What you have is someone that there's no conflict of interest. She just negligent, acted negligently, did not protect the child's interest, not just technically, but just disregarded them in a fundamental way.
Well, there's nothing in the record to indicate that it was any failure on the mother's part, really. We don't know what the reason was for the late filing. We do know it was filed late. We also know that when the guardian...
Without any request for relief, which might have been obtainable.
There was none. Mr. Perez never sought relief or extension of time to file a claim. Furthermore, and this is the thing, even you know, talk about the mother's issue, Judge Head took the protection of appointing a guardian, an attorney and guardian ad litem for the minor. And the ancillary hearing took place 8 months after that appointment, you know, 19 months after the claim was filed. And that attorney and guardian ad litem at no time raised to Judge Head any motion under Rule 60 for excusable neglect, any explanation for the failure to file the claim timely. As a matter of fact, his statement on the record to Judge Head is, we know we've got a problem. We missed the 30 days, and we got a problem. And the judge says, is there any reason, any case law you've got to suggest that a minor should have additional time to file a claim? To which he responded, none, Your Honor. There is no case law. And frankly, counsel for the appellant has not provided any case law for that. And Stone is again instructive on that issue, not only on the standard that this court would look at, but also in Stone, and it's significantly parallel to this case, although it involved a corporation. But in Stone, this court stated that the notice under Section 853N2 provides a potential claimant, quote, only with a notice of the opportunity to assert a claim. It's for the potential claimant to assert that claim within 30 days. It's an opportunity lost if you don't file it within 30 days. And that's been this court's consistent ruling for a long time. As a matter of fact, the court went on to say in Stone, quote, disputes about whether or not the government would have been prejudiced by considering any late filing petitions are irrelevant. In Stone, the claim was filed 78 days after receipt of notice, 48 days after the deadline for filing the claim. And this court said, it was untimely. The district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing your claim. And whereas in Stone it was 78 days after receipt of notice, in this case it's 74. In Stone it was 48 days after the deadline, in this case it's 44. So clearly, and there is no issue, it was filed late, there was no excuse given, no excuse offered. And I would just add that besides, in addition to the procedure.
During that 74-day period, was the defendant incarcerated?
Yes, Your Honor. The defendant was incarcerated at that time. Despite the fact that the appellant's claim was not filed timely, Judge Head still went ahead and proceeded to consider the merits of the claim. And that's where we get into the discussion about the nominee. So even if the appellant were to overcome the procedural failings, the ancillary hearing on the merits was held on November 17, 2011, to determine the appellant's legal right, title, and interest in the property. The sole evidence that was presented was that the deed was conveyed to her in 2001, which admittedly predated the conspiracy for which the defendant was convicted in 2006. But under Texas law, and that's cited in the government's brief, that raises a presumption, but a rebuttable presumption. And the courts can, and the court did, look at the facts and circumstances, and citing Troxell v. Bishop, the facts and circumstances preceding and to date, and to attending, and following the execution of the deed. The evidence on the record upon which Judge Head granted the motion for summary judgment was that the grandeur's father was a known drug dealer, had been a known drug dealer since the 1980s, that the grantor's father told the defendant in 2006, 2 years before he passed away, it's your property, I'm going to leave it to you, that the appellant's father, the defendant, always considered and treated the property as his own. He used the property extensively in his drug trafficking activities as a stash house, also as a place he rented to co-conspirators.
I understand all that. We may never get to the merits of this case, but it's not an open and shut case on the merits of forfeiture. It's very unusual in that regard. That grandfather, in his later years, who had since abandoned his operations, or at least he hadn't been in trouble recently, he might have been equally plausible here that he just wanted to be sure that his son didn't get that property forfeited, and so he gave it to his daughter. Now, that's not a, you know, that would be a
point well taken.
Perfectly plausible explanation for the way for a grandfather to act.
Point well taken, and my argument is, where's the evidence of that? That's speculation.
The deed trumps the representations of Omar. The deed under Texas law, which I think you have a tough road to hoe. The deed should trump that representation.
And, Your Honor, we do think the case can be decided on the procedural basis. Let me just focus for a minute, and I agree. The record is thin on the motion for summary judgment, but let me just suggest this. The deed in itself raises a presumption, but that presumption can be rebutted. And Judge Head allowed them an opportunity to say, what evidence do you have to rebut the fact that the property was the defendant's, that he was the beneficial owner?
Shouldn't it be the opposite way?
I'm sorry?
Shouldn't the government had to rebut that she was the true owner under Texas law because the deed is the prima facie evidence of ownership? So wasn't the burden exactly opposite, and that y'all should have had to put on evidence that it was not, that the deed wouldn't win, and unless you come forward with more you would have a burden, not them, to put on evidence that...
And the United States did present that evidence in support of its motion for summary judgment, though, and that evidence came in the testimony of Omar Alvarez at the sentencing, saying, hey, my father always said he was going to leave it to me. Also, and I think it's significant, and it's cited in the government's brief, this court's ruling in Oxford Capital Corporation versus the United States in 2000. And the court there was talking about the difference in the concepts of a nominee, a transferee, or an alter ego. They're independent bases for attaching the property of a third party in satisfaction, in that case, of a delinquent taxpayer's liability. But this is what's significant. The court said, a nominee theory involves the determination of the true beneficial ownership of the property. And so the evidence is that the true beneficial owner of this property was the defendant. The defendant rented the property. He didn't collect the rents and put it in a fund on behalf of his daughter. And I think it's also significant that the grandfather's wife, the appellant's paternal grandmother, is still alive.
Well, if he had collected,
where was her testimony?
If he had collected the monies and rentals of property and put it in her and used it as a drug house, put it in there, that would have been forfeited too.
And I think that's evidence of what his beneficial ownership was.
Yeah.
But, you know, where was the affidavit from the grandmother saying that, you know?
But it's your burden, not theirs. And she's not the nominee. He is.
No, you're right, Your Honor, but I was going through the evidence that was presented, though, to support.
She was the nominee at some point, and that's not accurate.
Yeah. But what I was going through was the evidence that was presented by the government in support of its motion for summary judgment, and that the defendant used the property extensively, that he, in fact, was the beneficial owner, that the family never lived in that property. They lived in Mission, Texas. Throughout the time of the conspiracy, and I think in response to this court's question, that family with a minor child never lived in that house. They always lived in the house in Mission. But again, did he use it as a stash house, et cetera? So, yes, there was some evidence presented in support of the motion for summary judgment.
Where was this house located? Exactly.
The house located in Sullivan City, Texas, which is along the border.
Where?
Sullivan City, Texas, along the border.
How far is that from the border?
That was one thing I was going to do, was look it up on the map. I know that there's testimony in the record that the house is on the border because the defendant got his cocaine from Mexico, was taken across the river, and put in the house.
So it was owned by people in Michigan that had this little house down there near the border, and that's what you're talking about.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. But, you know, going back to, and again, I think the government wins on the procedural basis alone, but so I'm not going to go too far out on a limb on the motion for summary judgment. However, I do think it's worth noting that in Rule 56, that Rule 56E talks about if a party fails to properly support an assertion of fact or fails to properly address another party's assertion of fact, that the court may consider the fact undisputed for purposes of the motion. So I understand the court's statement, it is our burden, and we did present evidence in support of the motion for summary judgment. That was what prompted Judge Head to say, what do you have to rebut? There's some evidence, and that's the phrase he used, there's some evidence in the record. He said, what evidence do you have to rebut some evidence? And they said, none. So, you know, that's what the record was before Judge Head. So based on that, Judge Head correctly granted the motion for summary judgment. And that is the government's argument. I'm available for questions if there are any questions.
Let me just ask you a technical question about a possible inadvertent error, and maybe it's not something that needs to be addressed. It was just noticed in preparing for argument that the criminal forfeiture order, which is record 396, mentions Audrey Drive, but not the 4th Street property. And the question is whether, I mean, if we were otherwise to agree with the government in this case, I'm not suggesting we will or we won't, but if we were, is there reason why that judgment would need to be corrected, or is that unnecessary? I'm not trying to ask you that on the spot, but if you could provide us, just look into it and provide us a short letter, and of course Mr. Foster could respond.
I'd be happy to. I would say that those were two separate forfeitures, separate houses,
yeah.
And that the ruling here does not impact on that because the conveyance, there was no conveyance of that property to the minor. The sole issue before us is the 4th Street property because of the conveyance. One other thing, given the time, that I would correct, there was a suggestion that the apartment complex, and this was going back to whether or not the mother had any conflict, and I think if I heard it correctly, there was a suggestion that the apartment complex may have been forfeited. It wasn't. There's nothing in the record. The United States hasn't proceeded against the mother. There's nothing in the record of any pursuit from a forfeiture standpoint or otherwise against the apartment complex. It was given to the mother, and as Judge Head would suggest and found in the record, similar to the nominee situation that was found with the grandchild. So with that, the government would thank the court.
Thank you. Nice job for the first time, Mr. Doyle. Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Foster, you saved time for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I think it's very important to note that it was an apartment, not an apartment complex. I don't know if that matters, but I think that it is significant. I know that Mr. Doyle has been very, very forthcoming. I know that he submitted some supplementary materials and went to the extra step of emailing me to make sure that I received them. So I wanted to thank him and the government for that. I think that there's a very good reason why the government is pushing so strongly on the procedural issues, because on the substantive issues, this might be the only time that the government has ever said, well, you know, I think that we're going to go with what a bunch of convicted drug traffickers said over a deed and a presumption under Texas law. And I know that we did have some discussion, which I thought was very interesting, certainly enlightening to me, about, you know, different potential rules that could come from this court. Certainly, if this court did not want to make a rule as strong and as broad sweeping as I suggested, that when you've got a spouse that's in trouble, there's a conflict there. And I think that that'd be a good rule. I think that'd be a very clean rule. I think it'd be certainly easy to follow going forward. But the rule under Mullane and the guidance that we've received from the Supreme Court is that it's got to be reasonable under the circumstances. And I think that this case has an awful lot of very interesting circumstances that are probably different than any case that's ever going to come forward. And so I think that just because I'm advocating for a rule, which I think would be very easy to follow, certainly, you know, be a strong, bright line rule, good for all of us going forward. I hope that Your Honors, if you don't see things my way on that, do leave open the possibility for a very narrowly tailored ruling where you state that, you know, under these very specific circumstances, the notice was not reasonable under Mullane. I really have nothing more to say, but I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you. All right, thank you, Mr. Foster. Your case and all of today's cases are under submission.